the real way. And every constitutional or human right, the civil rights of people protect, the trope is that the civil rights of people, your civil rights protect bad people from the cops, from accountability, from legal liability for the harm they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cops always find some weird loophole or workaround, or they just start kicking down doors and cracking skulls. And then
Sonia, we gotta
at
the hour. So I appreciate all that you're saying. I want to say, everyone, thank you for listening to The Gap. The Chauvin trial is not the end of the episode of Law and Order where we all get to tie it up and go home because justice was served. We didn't get justice, we got accountability. Tammy, what's coming up next?
Coming up next at 9 o'clock is Arab Voices, a show covering a wide range of issues such in the Arab world and Arab history, culture, civilization, Arab American civil rights and liberty, as well as immigration issues and more. Stay tuned, 9 o'clock, for the rest of the hours. You can go to kbo.fm, check out the schedule. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Tammy. This is The Gap. Thank you, the brilliant Althea, the multi-talented Sonia Terrestrial Angel. Thank you all so much. Have a fantastic Friday and weekend. Take care of each other, please, and stay safe.
See you on the radio.
Bye.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated, and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. I mentioned last week that this month, April, is National Arab American Heritage Month, a celebration and recognition of Arab Americans, their rich culture, heritage, and their contributions. We know that Arab Americans have always been, and for hundreds of years, a vital part of the American society. Today, and in recognition of that, I plan on airing a lecture titled The Early History of the Arab American Community by Professor Akram Khater, delivered at the University of Houston. And reiterating some of what I highlighted last week, Arab immigrants began coming to the U.S. in sizable numbers during the 1880s. Today, it is estimated that nearly 3.7 million Americans trace their roots to an Arab country. Arab Americans are found in every state, but more than two-thirds of them live in just 10 states. California, Michigan, New York, Florida, Texas, New Jersey, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Metropolitan Los Angeles, Detroit, and New York are home to one-third of the population. The majority of Arab Americans are native-born, and nearly 82% of Arabs in the U.S. are citizens. While the community traces its roots to every Arab country, the majority of Arab Americans have ancestral ties to Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Egypt, and Iraq. Arabs are ethnically, religiously, and politically diverse, but descend from a common linguistic and cultural heritage. For example, not all Arabs are Muslims, and not all Muslims are Arabs. For over a century, Arab Americans have made countless contributions to every aspect of the American society, from education to literature, law, art, science, astronomy, medicine, business, economy, technology, government, culture, film, poetry, storytelling, philosophy, politics, cooking, architecture, arts and crafts, language and calligraphy, music, and a whole lot more. Today on the show, I'm going to air a lecture titled The Early History of the Arab American Community by Professor Akram Khater. He delivered that lecture in 2019 at the Nejad and Zaina Faris Arab American Educational Foundation Annual Distinguished Lecture in Modern Arab Studies at the University of Houston. Professor Khater is a university faculty scholar, author, professor of history, and director of the Khairallah Center for Lebanese Diaspora Studies at North Carolina State University. The voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Abdel Razzaq Takriti, professor of history and the first holder of the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Arab History at the University of Houston.
Hi, my name is Abdel Razzaq Takriti, and I'm the Arab American Educational Foundation Chair in Modern Arab History here at the University of Houston. I'd like to recognize some of the wonderful people that make all of this happen. And really, this is one of my favorite events of the year. It is, in fact, my favorite event of the year because it brings together the community, the student body in this university, along with so many faculty members. And this is all made possible by the generosity of Nejad and Zaina Faris. Please give them a big hand. When Nejad and Zaina made a big gesture, they gave us some small change, only $250,000, you know. And they really showed the spirit of giving and of generosity in this community. And I do think that we have a lot to be proud of in the Arab community here in Houston. This is, as we always say, the only community in the United States that through grassroots efforts has established two major endowed chairs in the two major universities in the city in which it is based. Professor Osama Maqdisi, and sitting in the back of this room, he should be at the very front, who is the first endowed chair in the city that the Arab community raised funds for. And he came here in 1997 and has established a wonderful program at Rice University. I came here in 2015 after a very active effort by the community to establish my chair here at the University of Houston, and now we're working very hard to develop our program and to build a center for Arab studies eventually here in this place. Which brings me to the second subject, which is the Arab American Educational Foundation, this wonderful institution that allows us to bring these chairs and to build all of these initiatives in our two universities and well beyond in the city, which is the Arab American Educational Foundation. We have many of the officers of the foundation here, and they make us proud, and especially we have here amongst us the shining star of this community, Dr. Aziz Shebani. Dr. Shebani has an indomitable spirit. He's been working day and night to bring education to this town, to bring education about the Arab world to our museums, to our institutions, to our universities, and to our people, whether they're in schools or in institutions of higher education. So I am very grateful to him, as we should all be. Now, we're not the only institution that has been working very hard and to create this kind of knowledge base to introduce our people and their culture and their achievements. A lot of that work has been taking place in North Carolina through the efforts of our guest today, our guest speaker, our wonderful lecturer, Professor Akram Khater. He has managed to single-handedly build one of the most important centers for the study of our part of the world, the Khairallah Center for the Study of the Lebanese Diaspora. And he has really done an enormous amount of work to track the histories of Lebanese and Arab American communities across the world. I was just chatting with him today about the places he's about to travel to meet people, interview people. And really, he brings that human touch when he's dealing with the history of our people across the world. He's going to New Zealand. He's been to every Latin American space you can imagine. He's gone to every American city, doing an enormous amount of work to document the histories of Arab American communities in both South and North America, and of course in Australia and beyond. So it's incredible work that he's been doing. And I know this is a public lecture, but I want to say something about the scholarly value of what Professor Khater has been doing, beyond the archiving and beyond the institutionalization of this history. He has really anticipated a big trend in the field, which is the global turn and the transnational turn in history, with his earlier work on the diasporic communities and the migrations and the transnational linkages. This was before we had this big movement in history to study things on a global scale and to think about interconnections between different parts of the world. He was already doing that work when he did his PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. So we have here a very innovative scholar who's built an incredible career and has produced several books since he completed his doctorate and since he took up his post at North Carolina State University. And his career has been an incredibly successful one. He is currently a university faculty scholar. He is also a professor of history, and he is the Khairallah Chair in Diaspora Studies at North Carolina State. This is an enormous achievement to be able to have all of these major posts. In addition to that, Professor Khater has been bringing genuine public understanding around these themes through doing things like a PBS documentary on the history of Lebanese communities, through doing initiatives as traveling museum exhibits on that subject. And this is a great service because he's sharing knowledge. And in this way, we share similar values here at the University of Houston and at North Carolina State. We're trying to bring knowledge to the broader communities. And this is something that I appreciate. Professor Khater has paved the way for many of us to do that. He's really created a very successful model of doing that. And I am honored to present and welcome him today. Please give him a big, big hand.
Well, after this introduction, there's only one way to go down. It is truly a privilege. So, Alshi, Masal Khair. And good evening to those of you who don't know what Masal Khair is, which I suspect is not many here. It is truly an honor to be here tonight, and I would like to extend my thanks as well to Zaina and Nijad for their generosity, for the Arab American Educational Foundation, for Dr. Tikriti, who is, I've known about him long before I met him in person, and then when I met him in person, I was charmed 100 times over, as I'm sure most of you are. He is a dynamo, as is Osama. I just want to add a footnote to what he said about Osama. I mean, Osama is the doyen of Middle East historians in many ways, but I wanted his job, and you guys didn't give it to me. But I think you chose the better person. It is truly, I've been speaking to a few of you, and I said how marvelous it is, what an amazing community, what a vibrant community you are here, both intellectually and as sort of a public general community. It's really, truly an honor to be here. So I would like to thank Abed, as well as Paul Scott, who's not here, I think. He did all the logistical stuff, so thank him for me, please. And I would like to thank the University of Houston and the Department of History for hosting me here. And I am very thankful for you for taking the time on a rainy day to be here with us tonight. So the structure of this is supposed to be 45 minutes in which I present to you an argument and a survey, if you will, of Arab American history in about 30 minutes of questions and answers. I'm going to try, and I do tend to go fast, I'm going to try to go a little faster because I really would prefer to have more questions and answers, but we'll see what happens. So Arabs have largely been ignored in narratives of American history, appearing only at its margins. 19th century Orientalist representations, a century of Hollywood images, public policies, coordinated media campaigns, and decades of militarized encounters in the Middle East have formed and fed a concept of the Arab as the other. Someone who is physically and morally alien to America, harboring and villainously acting upon beliefs contrary to American core values. These long-standing impressions were only reaffirmed and magnified in public discourse after 9/11, when an Arab presence in America became to many symbolic of and synonymous with terrorism. While individually many of us have found welcoming homes, friends, and neighbors in the United States, collectively we remain subject to, at best, misunderstanding, but more frequently, deep-seated suspicions and even animosity. What is most puzzling about this liminal state of being at once living in, but not given space to fully belong to America as Arabs, is that Arab Americans have been citizens of the United States for nearly 140 years. And their experiences are, in many ways, the very narrative of modern America, and most certainly of its variant immigrant populations. They, we, were and are immigrants, similar to many other ethnicities, working hard to make a living and contribute to their and our newfound communities, all the while struggling to fit into a fissured social and economic order, complicated politics, and fraught racial landscape haunted by a painful past. So why do we remain, as an ethnicity, outside the body politic of America? Why do we remain hidden, even in multicultural spaces and popular culture, until we emerge as villains? There are many reasons for this. Orientalism, which I mentioned earlier, or the skewed and imperial representation of the Middle East and its people from the 18th century until today, plays a role. As you can see, for those of you who have access to YouTube, which I assume is everybody, just type in Planet of the Arabs. I think some of you may already have seen it, but you can already see a play on Planet of the Apes. And basically, it's a collage of films that were made from the silent era until now about how Arabs are depicted in Hollywood. Jack Shaheen, the very famous, and unfortunately now past Jack Shaheen, documented this. It is always, invariably, a challenge to find a single positive Arab role in Hollywood, in general. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, and the invasion of Iraq, to name but few conflicts that directly or indirectly involve the United States and the Middle East in the past 50 years or so, have certainly played an oversized role in villainizing Arabs in American popular culture. However, in addition to these factors, I would argue that it is our failure and inability, at least until recently, to tell our story as Arabs, in and of America, to situate ourselves within the normative, historical, and contemporary spaces of this country. But before I proceed, here I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the very hard and profound contributions of people like Dr. Alexa Naf and Dr. Michael Sleiman. I don't know how many of you know their names, but they were the pioneers in Arab-American history. In the 1970s and 80s, when nobody was doing this, they went single-handedly did that. Dr. Sleiman was a professor at the University of Kansas. I also want to give a shout out to the outstanding Arab American National Museum. I hope many of you have visited it. If you haven't, please take the time to do so, even though it's pretty far in Dearborn, Michigan, and all of its dedicated staff, and to the remarkable scholars and cultural producers who have been working diligently to change the state of being over the past 2 decades. At the Khairallah Center, we are also doing our modest share by dedicating ourselves to preserving and sharing these histories. Tonight, I would like to provide a general overview of the early history of Arab Americans stretching from the 1880s through the 1940s, and illustrate in necessarily sketchy terms how they were shaped by their migration to America, but more importantly, how in the process they transformed America in small and large ways. In other words, I would like to speak of how they are intimate and integral part of this multifaceted stories of America. At the outset, allow me a few words about terminology. I will be using Arab, Lebanese, and Syrian interchangeably, and quite frankly, inaccurately. To speak about the early immigrants who came to the United States from the Eastern Mediterranean, these identities were and are quite fluid, and their meaning always changing. I think it's no surprise to you that people have arguments about whether they are Phoenician or Arab, Syrian or Lebanese, and you know, I'm sure every time you get around Tabbouleh, people argue what Tabbouleh is. We discovered that it could be anything you want at that point last night. So, more to the point, early immigrants did not think of themselves in such large national terms. After all, Lebanon, Syria, and other Arab nation states do not really emerge until the 1920s and thereafter. Rather, they would identify with family and village, and for a larger identity, maybe their religion. And for some, the Ottoman Empire, until the 1920s anyway, remained quite relevant to their sense of self. The labels of Arab, Lebanese, and Syrian formed over time and were always debated and contested. So I am using them, though, interchangeably because the Lebanese have an imperial sense of what Lebanon means. So we kind of think that it takes over the rest of the Arab world. So you'll have to excuse that a bit. With that in mind, let's start at the beginning and ask 3 basic questions. Why did they leave? Where did they go? What did they do when they got there? So let's start, first of all, with why did they leave? And in many ways, here history and memory come in conflict. I am sure many of you have heard, if you are a descendant of those early immigrants, you've heard stories about possibly the terrible Turks, persecution by Muslims, or conscription into the Ottoman army. And with all due respect to those memories, because I do respect them, they're generally speaking are not true. The reason most people left in the late 19th century, early 20th century is the same reason the Italians left, the Poles left, the same reason the Greeks left. It's called labor migration. They went from an area where there aren't that many jobs into an area where there are more jobs. And I spent a lot of time to show you this nifty little chart. I hope you enjoy it. I have a little animations here. This is what I do in my free time, right? As you can see, one shows the price of silk, and silk was the major product in Mount Lebanon and the surrounding area in the late 19th century. And as the price of silk went down, you can see the number of people leaving went up. And that is not an accidental thing, because most villagers and even townspeople depended on their livelihood with the silk trade. Again, I can explore that in greater detail later on. This is a poet, Khalil Asad Rustum, who penned this poem in 1895, in which he describes, amongst other things, his own reason for leaving Lebanon. And I'll give you just a minute to read it, and you can see why he argues people were leaving Lebanon at that time. So the fact of the matter is, aside from the economic needs, steamship navigation, in which you have French primarily, but also American steamship companies beginning to send agents to encourage people to travel. It lowered the cost of travel, made it a little bit easier, about 3 weeks, generally speaking. And as you can see, they went across the Mediterranean, stopping in Alexandria most often. They stop in Marseille. From Marseille, you can take a boat either to South America or North America. La Touraine, for example, did the cross Atlantic from Le Havre, which is in the northern part. And then, this is back to Texas here. In fact, we tend to think that a lot of them came through Ellis Island, but in fact, they were the earliest illegal immigrants, quote unquote. They were crossing the Texas-Mexico border long before we had all this conversation about walls. And they did it very frequently, to the point where there were, even at that time, an immigration report about, quote unquote, the Syrians who are circumventing all their usual rules in Ellis Island. More often than not, the people who did not go through Ellis Island are the people who were turned back because of something called trachoma, a very contagious eye disease. Whether they had it or not is never certain, but they were certainly accused of it quite frequently. It was assumed that the Syrians brought trachoma just like the Jews brought pneumonia. And the irony of it is that neither actually were the major carrier of the disease. But generally speaking, as you can imagine, even from today, immigrants were seen as vectors for disease, which again today is proven to be completely wrong. But the point is they went everywhere. The mythology is that sometimes they would get in a boat thinking they're going to New York, but they end up in South America. That is, to a certain extent, true, but more often than not, they're going to reunite with family. So they kind of knew where they were going, including my grandfather who went to Uruguay, in Montevideo, Uruguay. And the numbers, again, like in terms of names, they are a bit inaccurate. I'd like to, you know, point out that this is United States census sources, but please do not assume that this is 100% accurate. It's to the best of our ability because census takers were very biased, especially in that time period. People coming from the Ottoman Empire were not keen on being counted, and a lot of times they would try to avoid being counted. So these numbers are the best guesstimates. I know that we like to exaggerate the numbers. I was once at a speech by Lebanon's foreign minister, Mr. Gibran Basile. At the beginning of his speech, there were 5 million Lebanese in Brazil. In the middle, there were 8, and by the end of it, there were 12. The Brazilian census shows there are 989,000 Brazilians of Lebanese descent. Disappointing, I'm sure. But we like to inflate the sense of importance by numbers. Understandable, but not always true. So, very quickly, as you can see, there's a trend. We start in the late 1880s, just as the price of silk is going down. It spikes up a little bit. We hit a bump in World War I when Lebanon is surrounded by a blockade by the French and the British. And a major famine strikes Lebanon, kills about a third of the population in what we know as central part of Lebanon today. Then we have an uptick, a very quick uptick, right after the end of World War I, and then it drops dramatically after the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, when basically we have a quota system established that stays in place until the Johnson Act of 1965 gets rid of the Quota Act. Between those 1924 and 1965, it literally goes down to a trickle. We do not have many people coming at that point. And then after 1965, there are many faces in this audience that came in that time frame, including myself, obviously. And here are some of the numbers that you can see from the various census, and we have been working with the U.S. Census to try to identify it. As you can see, we have two columns. One is how many people really immigrated, and then the number that were counted. And the difference is due to what, do you think? Procreation. Exactly. Those are the children that are born, and you can see the difference between 1900, not a whole lot of children, 1910, we're still close, and then it spikes in 1920, not surprising. That's when the people are getting older, settled, and they can have 1, 2, 3, 10 children, or however many you descend from. My grandfather seemed to want to father a lot of children. And the last question is, where did they go? They went everywhere. The one remarkable thing, I would say, about the immigration of early Arabic speakers, Lebanese, Syrians, whatever you want to call them, is that they literally went everywhere. There's not a spot that they did not end in. I mean, Abed was talking about New Zealand. I was talking to somebody earlier about Tierra del Fuego in South America, where you basically have the last restaurant before you get on a boat to go to Antarctica is owned by a Lebanese immigrant. And the senator of that province is of Lebanese descent herself. So they went everywhere. And that is not a common pattern. If you look at Italians, if you look at Poles, if you look at other communities, they tended to be more concentrated. Generally speaking, because most of them tended to be concentrated in industrial cities. That is why people came to America. Not for liberty, not for freedom, not because they were persecuted, although those things may very well be true in many ways, but they came because the factories in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the textile factories, and the Ford factories in Detroit needed workers very fast. The very same reason why we see, of course, continuing migration to the United States. That is really, and like most immigrants, they intended to come, make money, and then go home. Their intention was not to stay. Their intention was to go back and be rich peasants instead of poor peasants. That is the mentality they had. Two-thirds of them ended up staying, but that's because of different circumstances in some ways. So the reason they went everywhere is because they engaged in peddling. And there's a mythology that develops around peddling. And again, for those of you who descend our third or fourth generation yourselves, I'm sure you've heard the story. They came, they peddled, they opened the store, everything was great. And there's a certain element of truth to that. There are a lot of people that peddled at least a part of their lives, but not as much truth as you would think. And I'll get to that in a bit. But nonetheless, this is based on a network. What you basically would have is somebody in Indiana that is the hub, and he would bring people over, relatives or not relatives, that would basically, and he would give them wares to sell and send them off on the train routes. So anywhere trains went is where these people ended. From the mines of Montana and Wyoming and Colorado to the factories of Lawrence, Massachusetts and Dearborn, Michigan. From the southern part of Texas to the southern part of Florida. From California all the way to Washington. They literally went along these routes, and you can almost map them along the railroad line. So peddling becomes a very important notion. And for those of you who don't know what peddling is, this gives you a note. I love this ad. It shows a happy peddler and a sad peddler. The happy peddler happens to be getting his supplies from the store that's being advertised, Maoshi wa Ikhwanu. So, I mean, early on, there's this notion, mythology that develops that there's something inherent in these immigrants that make them want to peddle. It's the Phoenician blood, it's the Lebanese desire to succeed, something genetic. The answer isn't really quite that biological or genetic. The answer is more that peddling was easier to get into. You don't need a whole lot of English. You don't need much capital because you get a lot of stuff on credit. And you get trained very quickly a few gestures of how to go about selling. And the rate of success tends to be fairly high. There's one particular woman who arrives without her husband from Zahle. So she comes here, she leaves her husband behind because he was a bit an invalid, he couldn't travel. And she comes, arrives here on Christmas. By Easter, she's made $500. This is 1903. Now, this is a success story. Not everybody succeeded. There are a lot of people that were broken by peddling because it was not easy. It's not like you're going out and everybody loves you. There are many instances in which people were attacking you because you are an alien or a foreigner. Sometimes it's nature. There were two peddlers in North Dakota that got caught in a blizzard, and they were dead by the next morning. So it wasn't an easy life. Many days you would walk 40, 50 miles, and you're carrying about 30 to 40 pounds. This was hardcore, and you could start as young as 10, 12, and men and women could do it. That's the appeal of it. Anybody could do it, but at the same time, it really broke a lot of people. It was not an easy thing to do, and most people, the minute they can stop peddling, they did. Or at least the minute they can get a buggy and a horse, they would, because it's a lot easier to travel that way. And I've just sort of put one little sign here. This is from Wilmington, North Carolina, about some of the sort of pressures that a lot of these peddlers would face. So, as I said, peddling was just one of the things they did. You could say a lot of them perhaps even dabbled in it, but very quickly we find, if you look at that statistic from 1900, I don't know if you can see it clearly, but the point of that chart, whether you can read it or not, I'll translate it, is that not everybody peddled. There were a lot of workers. And as we will see later on, in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the quote-unquote Syrians were central to one of the largest labor strikes in the United States. They were very much involved in the labor movement in the United States, both in Dearborn as well as in Lawrence, and I'll get to that in a bit. But there were gravediggers, there were people who worked on the tramway, people who worked in textile mills, as I alluded to, factories that were in New York. The point here is that we cannot imagine that everybody went into commerce and everybody succeeded. Linda Jacobs, who was probably one of the foremost scholars of the early immigrant community to New York, had two grandparents. One is Mr. Jacobs, who still has a company in his name, he passed away, and a foundation that became fabulously successful in California. And her maternal grandfather failed at everything he did. And it becomes tragic. Some people became alcoholic. Some people took gambling. I mean, immigration, as you all know, I don't need to explain this to you, takes a lot of stress on you. You're leaving a social cocoon that at once is suffocating in a village life, because you can imagine, you know, I mean, when you go to Lebanon, everybody just jumps on you. Do you want to eat? You want to eat? You want to eat? And if you want to go read a book, are you okay? Why are you sad? Come back. So you understand the cocooning part, but at the same time, suffocating it may be, but it's also securing. You arrive here, different language, different environment, different food, different kind of work. It is a disorienting thing. So we should not be surprised that it took its toll on people. In order to sort of work against that, one of the first things they do is to try to build communities. And I'm not going to go through every aspect of the communities because there are quite a few things, but I'm going to focus on a few things. First of all is religion. Now, please do not misunderstand that everybody was religious. In fact, many people could not escape religion fast enough the minute they arrived here. We have about, at least in the case of the Maronites, we have about 2,000 letters sent between 1899 and 1932 to Patriarch Elias Ahwayig from the Maronites all up North and South America, primarily North America. And you can see the tensions, the troubles that go on in terms of that. But nonetheless, the daily encounters these immigrants had at work and society at large necessitated a self-conscious examination and recreation of their individual and collective identities. This reality, which for nearly two-thirds of immigrants who also entailed permanent relocation to the United States and other countries, and the anxieties it generated, propelled many immigrants to try to recreate a community that would anchor them amidst all the economic, social, and political forces tugging at the fabric of their lives. Family, food, language, social gatherings, clubs, letters home, return visits, and Arabic language newspapers were all part of this process. Equally, and at times more importantly, religious faith and practice was also at the heart of building and maintaining a community in America. We do not know the exact number of various sects that immigrated to the United States from the Eastern Mediterranean. We really don't. But they certainly included Maronite, Melkite Catholic, Syrian Orthodox, and a small number of Syrian Protestants, Sunni, Shia, Druze, and a few Alawites, as well as a small community of Syrian Jewish immigrants. But regardless of religion, and despite relocating thousands of miles from home and settling among ethnic cohorts, religion remained one important marker of identity and a source of solace. Thus, and especially during the period between the 1890s and 1950s, Syrian immigrants established churches, mosques, synagogues, and religious organizations to promote and maintain their faith and community in the Mahjar. For those of you who don't know what the Mahjar is, it's a land of immigration. One of the first steps, then, for those who sought refuge and solace in a transplanted religious community was to create one. And the starting point of that effort was to obtain a local priest, a rabbi, or sheikh. A letter from a Maronite community in members in Mannington, West Virginia, in 1898, to Batrak Elias Ahwayig, is one example of this need. Quote, "As your Beatitude knows, we, the Syrian children of your holiness, live in this country among different nations with different religions. Some are Catholic, but the majority is Protestant. We are in great need for priests to live amongst us and to perform their religious duties." In detailing their wants and desires, the writers, who identified themselves as originally from the towns of Sharri, Beirut, Tarza, and Beit Mire, noted the difficulty of finding a Catholic priest to serve their spiritual needs. Even when they did encounter one, they remained unable to properly confess because many of them cannot speak English well. The sorry state of affairs meant that the great majority of these Syrian immigrants went for years without a confession. or fulfilling their religious duty, which led to, quote unquote, falling away from the faith. What is worse, from the perspective of the writers anyway, is that some began to attend Protestant churches. In short, they and others in dozens of similar letters informed the patriarch the community's special welfare is at a perilous juncture without a Maronite priest. And by the way, these letters from 1899 to 1920 are very common. Brazil, Argentine, Cuba, a lot of people are saying this. And you can sort of imagine, because these rituals are central. Just to smell incense, al-bakhur, that moment in which you smell it, whether you're religious or not, whether you're really practicing or just a holiday Christian in this park, and or whatever faith you are, that moment when you hear that Syriac chant, something happens within your system. And that gives you, again, that notion of cocooning. I'm not romanticizing that, because as you'll see later, also there were problems. Surprise, surprise. Malkite Catholics and Syrian Orthodox face a parallel crisis. In the years and sometimes decades before immigrants could secure a priest and establish a church, they found alternative ways to worship. So the point is, they began to do that. The other element is establishing clubs. And I'm sure here in Texas you have many of these clubs, right? Somebody was telling me, I think, at lunch today, a graduate student of Abt was talking about the Sultan Club in Toledo, Ohio, that's been meeting. It's just a family club. It's been meeting since, I think, early 1900s, right? I don't know if the Jmeil family here has a club. They may very well do, but I mean, you can see all these families. And some of these guys get very, very persnickety about who can be in the club. I think you can probably claim Native American blood easier than to be a member of a family club. Anyway, so those were the other element here. And of course, what would community building be without a hafle? A'uzu billah, yani. You know, you have to have hafle. Dabke, dabule, kibinayi. Yeah, I mean, just our community in North Carolina, that's pretty much all we did for everything. But there's also sort of more, if you will, larger scale level. But you can see that the number of publications in Arabic. And it's really important to keep this in mind. The first movable type, developed in Arabic was in New York City for the Arabic press. I'm talking about movable type here, right? I mean, this is Linotype, which is a company, and they did it here. And this is just in North America and South America, you had an equal number of newspapers. And in many ways, again, we can go into greater detail. It's not simply that they started publishing. They also were beginning to mold Arabic, to transform it, partly because many of them were half-literate or semi-literate, but others because they needed to their new conditions in life. Language, they broke the rules in many ways. And critics from the Middle East always were very happy to tell them that they are lousy Arabic writers. But they didn't care, because they were creating a new kind of language, even as they argued amongst each other. And this is just a sampling of some of the stuff. At the Khairallah Center, one of our projects is to digitize and preserve all the newspapers that have and magazines published in North and South America, and to make them searchable with an Arabic OCR program that we're developing right now. In general, we don't really think about music very much, but again, I don't know how many of you listen to Arabic music, but even if you aren't born there, you sort of start humming along. I drive her crazy with Fairuz every morning because this becomes a habit, and my children make fun of me because I like Fairuz, very old-fashioned. So this is what Tony Abdul Ahad said. He's a singer and an oud player. He remembers there was very little public entertainment at the time, same time period. Money was scarce, but they got their pleasure out of these records. My uncles and father, they used to spend most of their money in records. My father paid as high as $8 in 1910. $8 for a record. Right? He used to buy the old 78s, and the 78s were terrible for Arabic music. The 78s could only hold 2 to 3 minutes. 2 to 3 minutes, you have started warming up. If you're doing Mawel or Mashah, you're just starting to warm up your vocal cords. Umm Kulthum, I mean, my gosh, it's like, you know, this is, you know, just practicing. So it really was a problem for them, and they actually started playing, transforming the music to fit the technology of the time. And poor Tony Abdul Ahad, he would, because while his uncle and father are drinking and listening and getting into the tarab phase, he had to stand and change the needle all the time, because otherwise, and crank it. So here are some of the names. I mean, this is all primarily on Washington Street and Lower East Side in Manhattan. It's all gone, unfortunately, and there's a small group that's trying to preserve whatever is left of these things. But all the recording studios, mostly in the 1920s, they opened. Ma'aluf, Ma'sud, Ma'aruf. They really couldn't think of any letter other than that. Star of the East, Abdul Ahad, Cleopatra, Nilophone, Metrophone, Arabophone, Golden Angle, and Asharq. And what's really interesting, this is a transnational in real ways. They would import singers from Palestine, from Lebanon, from Egypt, and they would tour the United States. And we're talking 1910s and 20s, and people would come out. I mean, these are obviously, these three were native-born performers. But the point is, you can sort of imagine these organizations. So I don't know if you can read the Arabic here, but this is the Grand Maharajan. So we graduate from Hafli to Maharajan in Raleigh, North Carolina. And these people would come from Florida, from Oklahoma. They would just all descend upon it, 2 or 3 days of dabke and music and drinking arak, you know, sort of like Mardi Gras a la immigrant, if you will. And the other element that we sort of see this creation of community is also at the level of intellectuals and writers. I mean, it's really just the numbers of people who wrote. This is a population of immigrants of, you know, few tens of thousands. We're not talking about millions. And they produce over 46 newspapers, and they produce 7 major, I'm talking here major writers, and 6 female major writers. And this is just in North America. South America is a whole different story in many ways, but it's, I mean, it's really quite remarkable to generate that kind of literature. Whether you like Gibran or you kind of gag every time somebody quotes him again to you, it doesn't really matter. But the point is, these guys are profoundly engaged. I mean, they were engaged, and you can see Mkhain Al-Aimi, who is one of my favorite writers. He's incredibly sarcastic. And he ended up leaving because he wanted to go back to Baskinta. But to him, it wasn't just a matter that they had to write just for nothing. They felt like they were on a mission. I mean, they really felt like they're the vanguard. Whether it is they were really self-aggrandizing, whether you think they're really full of baloney, it doesn't matter. But they really thought of themselves as this new generation that's transforming Arabic and Arabic literature and then sending it back. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence to indicate that they did do that. But aside from that, they built a sense of community, right? You can imagine then somebody sitting in Colorado, in Las Animas, Colorado, where there were about 300 immigrants. You probably don't know where Las Animas, Colorado is, do you? It's a mining town. Nejad, you know it. Well, Nejad knows it. And it's not a whole, but there are 300 people there in 1900. I mean, you think, what the heck are you doing there? But you can imagine somebody sitting there and reading a book, because they would ship these books all over the United States and Mexico as well, and they're reading it. And in doing so, as one theoretician, major theoretician of nationalism and nation, Benedict Anderson argues, you begin to create something called an imagined community. You feel you're beyond your village, you're beyond your family, you're part of something larger. And the way they wrote, they begin to write as Syrians, as members of the Arab nation, or as Lebanese. So they see themselves in this larger entity. And there's an argument to be made, by the way, that as at the same time that people living in these nations to be, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, as they were beginning to imagine a nation state, that imagination was also taking place in the Mahjar. There's a lot of relationship that goes on between the two. So at the same time that they were creating the sense of community, there were also tensions. And I don't want to romanticize that time period. And I'm going to go again quickly through these tensions that I've been addressing. And primarily, I'd like to focus on three things. One is religion, again. Two is gender. And three is race, because race becomes a very important topic in this regard. Just to put it very simply, look, if you look at this map from 1900, there are times when people right here in this whole area, when you look at how many people were there, there were one or two, right? I mean, that is lonely. Now, again, it could very well be that they're so happy they're away from anybody who speaks Arabic, and they could not imagine themselves getting away faster. It is possible, and I'm sure there were some, but there were also some that were just homesick. I mean, when I first arrived in the United States, I cried for 4 days. Right? Then I discovered cafeteria food, and then I was happy. This is what happens to teenagers. You know, just feed them and then stop crying. But it is homesickness. And I left a country where bombs were literally raining around our house, and I still was homesick. I mean, there's some mental issue there. Because it's home. So there's a sense of loneliness. And people, you know, there's a very famous song about this guy who gets into gambling. And his wife gives him money to go buy some oil. And of course, you know what happens. He goes and puts him on the horses, and he loses, and he's hiding from his wife. And his wife is looking for him all over the neighborhood. So it's really kind of a traumatic relationship. But people begin to break under this. So in terms of gender, so constructions of gender, as intersected with race and class, created another kind of tension here. To understand these particular tensions, it's important to note at first that Arab women emigrated to the Americas nearly as much as men did. I know this sounds self-evident, but for the longest time, women had no presence in the narrative of immigration. And as you can tell from these numbers, At the lowest, there were about, you know, I mean, we estimate about 33-34% of immigrants, and the highest was about 40-some percent. In other words, they left. They left and came along. Some left to join family. Other left to escape bad marriages, including the mother of Gibran Khalil Gibran. Her husband was a drunk and in trouble all the time. Others left because they had to make a living, because their husbands couldn't anymore in Lebanon, because of the economy there. So there are different reasons why they are really leaving here. But regardless of why they immigrated, nearly all women worked. In New York, for example, we know that officially 40% of Arab immigrant women worked either in peddling or in a factory. In fact, though, historian Alexanoff, who I referred to earlier, contends that anywhere between 75 and 80% of the women peddled during the pioneer years, which she defines as 1880s to 1910s. So the fact of the matter is, you can see that even from the sermon that was delivered by Father Basil Kherbewi, he thought that there was something troubling about women working, that the honor of the family is going to be destroyed by that. And there was a great deal of opposition and concern about women working, because in some ways it upsets the patriarchal order. The idea that women are working, not in a village context near family, but they're working now on the streets peddling or working in factories next to men. And in fact, if you look at factory work, 90% of women in Lawrence, Massachusetts, immigrant women, work in the factories, right? The idea there is that somehow the honor of the family is being exposed here, both because the man could no longer afford to take care of the family, but also because of sexual innuendos. And these things did happen, in which, you know, a woman arrives, finds her husband living with another woman, she goes somewhere else. A woman leaves her husband because she doesn't like him anymore. So the tensions that are happening here are real, and it's beginning to, you know, influence a lot of people. The next element is race. I'm sure you're shocked by that. Despite their labors, civic contributions, and military service, Arab Americans face discrimination and racial violence. So this is the precursor to flying while Arab. This racial animus populated the American press. One Iowa newspaper, for example, ran an article in July 1901 simply titled, "Don't Like Arabs." Just 6 years later, Congressman John L. Burnett, who basically nationalized these complaints, he took them to the national level, proclaiming that, quote-unquote, Syrians were the most undesirable of the undesirable peoples of Asia Minor. I didn't know that, but now I'm glad to know that. In 1914, Senator from North Carolina, F.M. Simmons, probably one of the most racist senators, I hate to say it, from North Carolina, went further. These Arab immigrants are nothing more than the degenerate progeny, the spawn, no, not of the devil quite, but the spawn of the Phoenician curse. This is the one moment where Phoenician isn't positive. Edward Corsi, the U.S. Commissioner of Immigration and Naturalization in New York District, wrote that the Syrian is a doubtful element of a Mongolian plasma. I mean, I feel so warm at heart to know that I am that. One of the most violent manifestations of this anti-Arab sentiment came about 1929 when Ula Rumi, Dar al-Ahmar, a Syrian grocer or Arab grocer in Lake City, Florida, was lynched by a mob after a dispute with the local police chief. And Ula had immigrated with his wife Hasna to first Valdosta, Georgia in 1906, where he had a run-in with the KKK, partly because he was a bootlegger and Georgia was bone-dry state long before prohibition, but also because he spoke to a white woman in an unseemly way. And he was taken out and he received a beating, and then he and his wife, this was in 1926 in Valdosta, Georgia, then he and his wife Hasna and their children moved to Lake City where they had relatives, the Musa family, and they settled there, and unfortunately 3 years later, both she was shot by the police chief and her husband was taken to jail in the middle of the night. He was taken out and his body was riddled with bullets. Michael Shdeed, a doctor in Elk City, Oklahoma, at the same time, solemnly reflected on Arab immigrants' marginalization, writing that, quote, "Syrians are subject to being ostracized. It permeates the mass of Americans without regard to class or station in life." And what's interesting, he saw the middle class as the worst of it. That is why the KKK has grown in every town and city in America. Now, other Arab Americans did not agree with him. They actually quite disagreed, like the Irish Americans who preceded them and their Polish, Italian, and Jewish contemporaries. For some Arabs, quote, "to attempt to enter the white race was a strategy to secure an advantage in a competitive and racialized society." This kind of strategy crystallized around the naturalization case of George Dow, a Syrian immigrant living in South Carolina. My colleague Sarah Gualtieri is the person who first wrote about this case. So George immigrated to the United States in 1889. I think he was originally from Batroun, eventually settling in Somerton, South Carolina, where he ran a dry goods store. In 1913, he filed for citizenship, which was denied by the court because he was not, quote-unquote, a free white person. as stipulated in the 1790 U.S. naturalization law, and fomented under the Naturalization Act of 1870 and Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. For the Syrian community, this was a crucial test case because it legally closed the door to citizenship, threatening their residence and livelihoods in America. But the community's struggle with a fluid concept of free white person had begun even before George Dow, with Costa Najjour, who was denied naturalization in 1909 by an Atlanta lower court because he was too dark, quote unquote. In 1913, Feris Shahid, application was also denied in South Carolina court because, quote, he was somewhat darker than is the usual mulatto of one half mixed blood between the white and the Negro races, end quote. In rendering this decision on the Dow case, Judge Henry Smith, who was, you know, an unmitigated racist in many ways, argued that although Dow may appear to be a free white person, the legislatures of 1790 meant white Western Europeans. To make a long story short, this is when the Syrian community, the Arab community, the Lebanese community, whatever you want to call them, mobilized, and they created a defense fund, and they hired two Jewish lawyers from New York to defend them. And the Jewish lawyers were hired specifically that because they were very prominent, but also the Jewish lawyers wanted to take this case because they were afraid that if the Syrians were first decreed non-white, next comes their turn. Because as you know, the KKK was targeting immigrants, it was targeting African Americans, and of course it was also targeting Jews and Catholics. Catholics were really not very welcomed by the KKK. So if you want to know when we became white, you can thank George Dow, or not, depending how you feel about it. We've been trying to talk to the Census Bureau about changing some things, but that is why, from that point onward, Syrians and then, of course, Arabs were counted as white in the United States Census. The argument, interestingly enough, at least for historians, I'm just a historian geek, what can I say, is that Christ was white, and because Syrians were all Christian, not true, therefore they have to be white. And that same argument was given to the South Africa Supreme Court a year before and to the Australia, against the Australia White Act 2 years later. The same exact argument. Because in three racialized societies, South Africa, the United States, and Australia, Syrians, Arabs, Lebanese were under threat of being excluded from the body politics and citizenship. Now, I promise that it's not just simply a story about these immigrants coming and going, but rather I would argue that in their very own ways they transformed America radically. And I use radically here both in terms of the type of politics that they practiced, some of them anyway, the minority of them, but also in the major terms. And again, here I would like to focus on three things. One is labor, one is medicine, and the other is performing Arabness. And I'll come to that in a bit. This is one of a project we're also working on. I mentioned Lawrence, Massachusetts. And again, Lawrence, Massachusetts was the largest industrial town around the turn of the century. It was literally 80% immigrants from everywhere you can think of. French Canadian, Belgian, Syrians, Irish, Italian, you name it. The whole town was immigrant, and they all came to work in the factories. In 1912, there was a major walkout because at that time, the owners of the textile mills were cutting pay. And the first people to walk out were Polish women workers, but very quickly, the Syrian working class also stepped out of there. They joined the strike. And this was truly one of the most considered to be the most major labor strike in the United States history. And what is really interesting about it is that the strike had a steering committee, and the steering committee had an overrepresentation of Syrian workers. Right? Now, the community as a whole wasn't always in agreement. There were two newspapers, Al-Huda, that was owned by Naum Karzil, and Mir'at al-Gharb, by Najib Diab. And both of them butted heads all the time, basically for ideological reasons, but also religious reasons. Naum was Maronite, Najib Diab was Syrian Orthodox. But Naum thought of himself as Lebanese, Najib thought of himself as Syrian. But the point is, they both took different sides of this conflict. But at this moment, what is really interesting is that many of these immigrants had just arrived, maybe 5-10 years, and very quickly they become part of this labor movement. Now, whether you like labor movement unions is completely irrelevant here. You could hate them for all I care. But the point is, this was considered to be the major political movement on the left by working class. And these guys, who primarily were coming mostly from village life, very quickly became part of that and shaped it in their own ways. The other way, you probably can tell my politics from the examples I'm choosing, is somebody from Lockhart, Texas, and somebody from Elk City, Oklahoma. Both of them, doctors. Michael Shdid is from Marjayun. I'm sure you probably have heard of Anthony Shdid. Anthony is mildly related to him. Anyway, Michael comes very early with his mother and brother and sister, and he peddles early on, gets enough money, goes to Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, becomes a medical doctor, and he becomes the executive vice president of the American Socialist Party, right? And he goes and puts himself in Elk City, Oklahoma. I don't know why you would want to do that, because Elk City, Oklahoma was like, you know, one of the bases of the KKK. But one of the things that he did is he believed in this idea of socialized medicine. In fact, this idea of what we consider Medicare now, he started the first cooperative medical practice because he was looking, he comes from a family of 12. Nine of them die because of dysentery before they leave Lebanon, nine. And that's why he became a doctor, because he believed that nobody should die just because they have no access to medicine. And when he comes to Elk City, Oklahoma, he finds that the farmers in Oklahoma and in northern part of Texas, northeastern Texas, were equally dying in large numbers because the local town doctors were basically asking for exorbitant prices for their fees and providing medical care that was subpar. And so he comes up with the idea of cooperative medicine, very much modeled around cooperative farming. And Herbert Nasur from Lockhart, Texas, who ends up opening a hospital similar to that in Austin, Texas, also does exactly the same thing. And both of them run, as you can imagine, afoul of the AMA. Finally, we come to this kind of thing that is performing Arabness. There are many other ways in which these people transformed it. But Arabness was transformed from the early world exhibitions, particularly in Chicago, when you begin to see small Cairo and Morocco and camels and donkeys and the hoochie hooch dance, or belly dancing as we like to call it, that was really becomes wildly popular in the United States in the 1900s and 1920s, all the way through the 1920s. But this is an example of one person. In her lifetime in the 1920s and 1930s, her name is Rahmi Haidar. Please ignore the honor to, she made up a notion that she descends from a royal family in Baalbek. But I mean, it doesn't matter because she's performing. She herself comes from a Maronite background. She gets educated a bit in Saida at a Protestant school, ends up in LA where she continues to take some classes, and then she goes on a two-decade tour of Canada and the United States. She did 400 performances. This woman was like literally a one-woman show. But what is really interesting about her is what she says, right, in some ways. I mean, it's hidden here, two things that she sort of proclaims. One, she flips Orientalism on its head. She goes to the most conservative audiences. She always performed in churches, small town churches, very conservative audiences, generally speaking. And Near East Foundation basically sponsors her. And there she proclaims to them, you do not know Christianity. You do not know the Holy Land because you're not from there. I am the only person, because my name is Princess Rahmi Haidar, not me personally, but her. I am the one who can interpret for you. And she would actually put on displays. So that's one element of her, right? That she would go right into the heart of this Protestant world that was in a revivalist mode, that was proclaiming itself to understand Christianity. And my colleague Osama wrote a brilliant book called Artillery of Heaven, specifically about some of these more, one would argue, Northeastern missionaries, but the same kind of trend, this notion that the Holy Land becomes an American thing, that they are the ones who will describe what Christianity is, hence the missionary effort. And many of them were probably very decent human beings. But the point here is she goes into these places and she flips the narrative on its head. And Lucille Burgess becomes her companion for all her life. They strike a friendship and they hang out together. And they always leave a little bit of whispering campaign behind them wherever they go, she and Lucille. It's not quite clear what their relationship was, but they always performed one thing, which is Naomi and Sarah, a play. And what is really amusing about Naomi and Sarah, and you would see that as early as the 1930s, is the LGBTQ community considers them to be the first lesbians. I mean, so she has this audacity about her. She made money. I mean, this is how she made her living. So I think partly she's making money. But she was really insistent. Like, one of the things she says, belly dancing can only be done fully clothed. None of this hoochie-hooch outfits that you people have, right? So in her encounters, you can imagine in her daily encounters, one can argue, well, so what the heck, you know? So she performed. What does that do? Well, here's where the crux of my argument is. So whether they were in America, but for a fleeting moment, lingered much longer, or even settled here, whether they served in the army or escaped the draft out of self-preservation or moral objection, whether they accumulated wealth or struggled to make ends meet, whether they fought against racial hierarchy and violence or tried to rise higher in its rungs, whether they wrote the Transcendental Bible of the 1960s America, Gibran and the Prophet, or established the first Catholic church in New Bern, North Carolina, whether they were well known or hidden from our view, regardless of who they were and what they did, they were and are at the heart of the American story. They interwove themselves into the fabric of America, and their individual and communal stories, individual threads and collective weaves, give shape and meaning to an ever-changing tapestry. Thank you so much.
What you just heard was a lecture titled The Early History of the Arab American Community by Professor Akram Khater. He delivered that lecture in 2019 at the Nijad and Zaina Faris Arab American Educational Foundation annual distinguished lecture in modern Arab studies at the University of Houston. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.